The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Phoebe Novakovic has been the CEO of General Dynamics since 2013. Since she took over, General Dynamics shares have climbed over 180%. On this episode of Peer to Peer, I meet with Phoebe Novakovic at a General Dynamics research facility in Sterling Heights, Michigan. There, we spoke about the future of the aerospace and defense industry, and I got to see their Abrams main battle tank up close.
When you became the CEO of General Dynamics in 2013, there weren't that many women who were aerospace defense executives. Did you ever think when you were joining this company in 2001 that you could rise up to be the CEO?
I never thought I'd be the CEO. I think that would be highly aspirational. I've always been a big believer in you do well in life by doing the job in front of you very, very well, being part of a team and serving that team. But I never could have believed that this would happen.
So do you get tired when people like me ask you what it's like to be a woman and being the CEO of an aerospace defense company, or you get asked that a lot?
I think you and I have talked about this before, I approach this job primarily as a person, largely one formed by being a woman, but not exclusively. So I think about myself as a person and in this position, not so much a woman.
Your stock is up 180% since you became the CEO. Do you think under President Biden, defense spending may level off and therefore it may be harder for aerospace defense companies to do as well?
So I think defense spending historically has been driven by the threat or the perception of threat. And it is not a particularly safe world at the moment. That's number one. Number two, President Biden has been a lifelong supporter of national security. So this budget that he submitted to Capitol Hill was a nominal increase. Importantly, all of our programs were fully supported because of their criticality to the warfight.
Most of the large aerospace defense companies have moved to Washington. Do you see the Pentagon leaders from time to time? Do you go see the secretaries of Army or Air Force or Navy? Or what do you do in terms of interacting with them?
So I think it's important that we know our customer, both on the uniform military side, and we tend to try to know them as well. And then with each change of administration, we try to get to know the primary decision maker so we can get inside their decision space, help them think about, again, what we can provide. So I spend some time with all of them in our major customers. So that would be primarily the Army and the Navy.
The American people obviously have a high regard for our military, but they don't tend to think of the defense contractors as highly as they do of the military. So do you think there's any reason for that?
So I don't know that they're particularly not beloved, but this is the way I think about it. If the U.S. cannot avoid war through diplomacy or deterrence, it goes to war, and it goes to war with the U.S. defense industrial base. We cannot go to war as a nation without us. We make all the products and services that provide our service people with the weapon systems and protective devices they need to survive and win.
Because of consolidation in recent years, we now have essentially five major defense companies. Do you think that's enough? Should we have more competition, or do you think that's okay?
So competition is driven in the defense industry by two things. One, the number of new weapon systems coming out, and they're relatively constrained, say, compared to the 80s when you had a lot more defense companies. And two, the complexity of each of the weapon systems. So the capitalization requirements for defense companies, the large defense primes, and we're one of them, are significant. So given those capitalization requirements, and given that the intimacy that we need to have with our customer, I think we're pretty well balanced at the moment. And by the way, when you think about competition, we have a monopsony buyer with enormous purchasing power. So while we may be in duopolies or some people in monopolies, we are up against a very powerful customer. So there's a lot of shaping that happens in our contractual discussions with our customer.
But sometimes people say that the defense budget is very high because the cost overruns of new weapon systems and so forth. Is that a fair criticism, that sometimes there are cost overruns that are very, very high?
So if you think about the complexity of modern weapon systems, it is not unusual for some of them to have early on in the production or the development some cost overruns. But it's incumbent upon us as a defense industry is that once we understand the technology and then how to build it and how to build it effectively, to continue to take costs out as we go down our learning curves. And that's an important part of the value equation we have with our customer. It's taking driving costs out of systems.
So today, what are the biggest challenges for General Dynamics and what are the biggest opportunities?
So I think in any business, the challenges are solving complex problems that come to you. You know, the problems that come to me and my senior leadership team for resolving tend to be highly complex and nettlesome. So your ability to solve those complex problems are an important element, I think, of the value that we add to the company. And then I think opportunities, you always want to make sure that you've got a creative enough mind, an open enough mind to be able to see around square corners. What am I missing? You know, the why questions are really powerful. Why are we not doing this, or why are we doing this? I ask those questions a lot, and in the answers, you can sometimes tease out some real opportunities, some hidden things. But thinking creatively about opportunities and problems is really important.
And what about the industry generally? I think they have big challenges now as the defense budget probably comes down a bit.
So I think that we are all responsible and we have an obligation to find the latest and best technologies that we can for our customers and deliver them in the most cost-effective manner we can. And I think that that's a challenge and an opportunity for all of the big defense companies.
Let's go through the major divisions you have at General Dynamics. So one is the Marine Systems. Now, you before you became CEO, you were the head of Marine Systems, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think I've got it right. There were 68 submarines now in the entire U.S. Navy fleet. Do we really need a lot more submarines, or are we just kind of replacing the ones we have, or do we need more than 68, which is, I think, the number we have?
So I personally believe that the more submarines, the better, and while people may be jaundiced that and skeptical of my view, given where I sit, I think from a national security perspective, U.S. underwater supremacy is critical to our national security, and the more submarines that we can put in the water, the better off we are to protect our shores as well as to protect our assets overseas.
So it takes a long time to build a submarine. Is it like 3 years, 4 years, 5 years?
So the attack boats, when we're on about our 20-something attack boat, which is the Virginia-class submarine, takes about 70 months to build. We are building the ballistic missile submarine replacement in the Columbia class, which is replacing the Ohio class as part of the nuclear deterrent. That'll take us 84 months. So these are long, complicated build cycles.
And what does it cost to build a submarine? I assume it's not cheap.
So the Virginia class is about $2 billion a submarine, but they are highly survivable weapon systems.
And
by the way, as we've come down our learning curves, we have driven costs out of those submarines. So again, that's part of the value proposition with our customer.
Let's talk about another division, the land division, which is, I assume, the division that makes this tank.
Yes.
All right, so why are tanks so important today? Because with cyber and kind of missiles being launched off of submarines and so forth, do we really need tanks to kind of help the military that much?
So since the dawn of human time, wars are ultimately won. If they can't be avoided, they're won with boots on the ground by taking territory. I don't see that paradigm changing anytime soon. If we get into a really hot war, you need your tanks, you need your army to take land.
You have an aerospace division.
Yes, we do.
And there, the principal product is Gulfstream jets, is that right?
Yes.
Is there a reason why you're not in the military jet business, unlike some of your competitors?
Well, General Dynamics, before the big sell-off, you recall General Dynamics in the height of the Reagan buildup was the largest defense industry. The CEO at the time believed, and I think appropriately so to some extent, that it was important to sort of liquidate at the end of the Cold War. And so he systematically went through and sold off units of defense, including what was at the time General Dynamics fighter jet business. So we're out of that business.
All right, so you're in Gulfstream. Now, Gulfstream is mostly a business jet business, I think.
Almost exclusively.
Okay, and so with COVID, I assume business people weren't flying around as much. Were they buying as many jets?
So Gulfstream is a pretty cyclical business. We're economy facing, and as goes the world economies, that tends to drive our demand. And this was the third economic perturbation that I have seen since I've been at General Dynamics. So what we have learned is to be a good cyclical, and that's drive out costs faster than your revenue declines. So last year, we were the only successful aerospace OEM to make a profit, a significant profit at $1 billion. And we did that by reacting very, very quickly to the change in the marketplace. So demand was down as a result of the economic perturbations caused by COVID, but demand has nicely begun to recover. And we are in a very strong position in that recovery.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
So let's talk about your last division, which is your information division, which I assume is mostly cyber-related things and things you can't probably talk too much about. But is that where the greatest growth is going to be for aerospace defense companies in cyber and other kinds of information technology?
So cyber is embedded in almost every single one of our programs, including the main battle tank. The upgrades that we make and the continual improvements that we make to upgrade the technology in, for example, that platform all include cyber protection of multiple layers. So cyber is a growth area and has been for quite some time in the defense industrial base. We are very active and have been for 20 years in the cyberspace and will continue to see growth, but I don't see it as the exclusive growth. In our business, what's driving real growth on the defense side is submarines.
So one area we didn't talk about that is an area that some people think is important in aerospace defense is space. So some companies, some of your competitors are building things for the space world. Are you thinking about getting into space?
So we have some components, some lines of business that serve largely as a merchant supplier, some of the space companies, and that's a good place for us. We've made our large capital bets elsewhere.
Let's talk about your own background for a moment and how you came to be the CEO. So where did you grow up?
I grew up pretty much all over. My dad was in the Air Force, and we spent a lot of time in Europe during the Cold War. And I got a real sense of being an American. Germany was still relatively poor in the 60s, coming out of World War II, and not the major industrial power that it is today. And we had a real sense of what the United States had done to save Europe.
Now, your father was a Serbian immigrant to the United States, is that right?
Yes. So my father's family suffered from totalitarian regimes, both on the fascist side and the communist side. And they were fortunate enough to escape with their lives during World War II. And it was their dream to come to the United States, because when you have suffered from both types of totalitarianism, you treasure democracies, and particularly a market-based democracy. And he is an avid patriot, as is my mother. And they imbued me with that same sense of patriotism.
So you grew up in various places in Europe and the United States, and then you went to college at Smith.
Yes.
So did you study aerospace defense at Smith, or no? What did you study?
No. I was a government major and a philosophy minor. And I got a superb liberal arts background and education. So I learned to write and I learned to think in college. Those are two critical values.
Okay. So most people that graduate from Smith probably don't wind up in the CIA, be my guess.
Most, yes, I suspect
but
that's accurate.
So when you were interviewing for jobs at the end of your college career, Did you tell people, I want to be in the CIA, or how did you happen to get into the CIA?
Well, I had a sense of service to my nation, and it seemed a good place for me. So much in life, as you and I've talked about before, is finding place. And it was, the agency was opening its doors to women, and so it was a good opportunity for me. And I really enjoyed the service that I was able to provide.
How long were you in the CIA?
About 4 or 5 years.
And were you a CIA agent, or were you a spy, or undercover? You can't say even today.
So we were what were called case officers. So you might, in the common parlance, think about those as spies.
When you were doing that, could you tell anybody what you were doing, or what did you tell people you were doing as a career?
Well, we had various stories that we told, approved stories, and I think we'll leave it at that.
Okay, but your parents, did they even know?
My parents knew.
So after you did that for a while, you decided to go to where, business school?
Yes, so the Cold War was winding down, and yes, and decided to go to business school.
All right, so you went to Wharton, and then after you have a Wharton MBA, I assume it's easy to get a job. Was it easy for you to get a job?
No, it was extremely difficult. I had a rather iconoclastic background, and I was 7 months pregnant, so it was very hard to get a job.
You have a CIA background, you're 7 months pregnant, and you find that employers aren't interested in hiring women like that?
I had a number of interviews. I remember one in particular. I wanted to work for a steel company because I like making things. The tangible value of seeing, you know, the fruits of your labor. And I walked in, and now here they are at a hiring fair at Wharton. I walk in and they say, we're not hiring. And I said, well, I understand you're not hiring me, as I waddle out of there.
So you finally got a job at the Office of Management and Budget, which runs the budget of the United States government. So what did you do there?
So I started out as a budget examiner and was fortunate enough to work my way up and ended up running the National Security Division, which was responsible for all defense and intelligence spending submissions to the Congress.
Okay, so after a while you decided, I had enough of this. The government salary is good, but not that good. You decide you want to go into business. And you got a position in 2001 with General Dynamics.
Yes, I had a stopover for 4 years at the Pentagon and then to General Dynamics. And I went there because I remember thinking very distinctly in these seminal times in your life when you have perhaps a bit of epiphanies. I sat at my desk one afternoon thinking, I can't afford to put my children through college. And I happened to know a number of CEOs, including the CEO of General Dynamics, and I called him and I said, I'm going to be leaving here soon if you ever would be interested, and called a couple of the other CEOs, and I was fortunate enough to go with General Dynamics.
Okay, so you went to General Dynamics in 2001, and what was your initial job there?
So I was in strategic planning, but think about that more as special projects for the CEO, and I ultimately kept a series of jobs as I moved up the chain at General Dynamics, but I was also the chief of staff to the then CEO. And I learned a lot about how a very, very effective, powerful CEO manages a company. I learned a lot watching a superb CEO operate.
And you said, hey, I can do this job as well as this guy at some point?
No, that would be the height of hubris. Okay. And I've never suffered from that.
Okay.
I think I was the beneficiary of a lot of learning. So I was blessed with that.
Today, as you look at the opportunities that women have to be chief executives, do you think they're much better than when you were coming along? And what do you advise young women who want to be a CEO about the best way to prepare to be a CEO?
So I think there are more opportunities for women than there certainly were in the late 70s when I entered the workplace, and that is throughout the food chain. I tell, whether it's young women or young men, if you want to do well in this world, be a part of a team, serve your team well, and do the job in front of you as best as you possibly can. And in functional organizations, the rest takes care of itself. In a dysfunctional organization, all bets are off. Get out of it.
What would be the skill set that a CEO really needs to be successful in today's environment?
So I think a good leader needs fundamentally good character. Good character is required. I think a smattering and a wholesome capability set, in whether it's intellect or finance or ability to think strategically or solve complex problems, all those things are really important. And frankly, perseverance. I mean, sometimes you just have to never stop, never quit, never give up.
So you have three daughters.
I do.
And so you obviously got a private sector job, so you could help support them and get them through college. And you have now, again, four grandchildren?
Four grandchildren.
Okay, so what do you do for rest and relaxation? Spend time with your children and grandchildren?
Well, that's joyful, but I wouldn't call it restful or relaxing. Three toddlers and one newborn is hardly relaxing. But my husband and I walk a lot, hike a lot, and we talk a lot. He's finishing his doctorate at Princeton Theological Seminary in ethics. And so I find those kinds of conversations really stimulating and interesting. They're a respite for me, but they're also a lot of mental gymnastics to kind of keep up.
Have other people said it seems in Congress to have a spouse who is getting a degree from Princeton Theological Seminary and is very spiritual, presumably, and you're in the aerospace defense business. Has anybody mentioned that? Seems unusual or not?
Well, I think it probably is a bit unusual, but I think when you're in leadership positions, it's important to look at all of your decisions through a moral prism, irrespective of the industry that you're in, and to make sure that you're doing the right thing, and to constantly question, am I doing the right thing? Is this the right thing? And if you don't ask yourself those questions routinely, then I think you run the risk of failing to see potential error.
So what's the greatest pleasure of being the CEO of General Dynamics, and what's the biggest downside?
Well, I think these jobs are such great privilege. I don't think I see a particular downside. The pleasure is the people and the team. We have a highly functional, very transparent, very cohesive team. And frankly, you know, it was an interesting outcome from COVID. Crises bring out the worst and the best in people. And while we entered the COVID crisis as a very coherent, powerful team, we emerged even stronger, forged. And that brings me a lot of satisfaction.
Thanks for listening. To hear more of my interviews, you can subscribe and download my podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.